Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Margaret Somerville makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here some years ago talking about her book on the ethical imagination. But she's written numerous books. I should introduce her formal position at the moment, which is Professor of the Faculty of Law and the Faculty of Medicine at McGill University in Canada. I think she'll be returning to Australia shortly to take up a position at the Notre Dame University in Sydney. She's also the author of Death Talk, The Case Against Euthanasia and Physician-Assisted Suicide, and most recently, Bird on an Ethics Wire, Battles About Values in the Culture Wars. And it's on that broad topic that Dr. Somerville is going to speak for us tonight. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared, and it really is a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to coming back to my original home, which is Australia. I've been away for 40 years, which is a long time. I'm coming back to Australia mid-year, and I'm going to be joining the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Notre Dame, Australia, the Sydney campus, and I've been away for 40 years in Canada, at Canada's most prestigious university, which is McGill University. And I've been I'm jointly appointed on the Faculty of Law and the Faculty of Medicine. But almost all of my work is in ethics. And also a very large proportion of my work is not directly within the university, but taking the university out into the public square and giving to people what I think they need, which is information about the incredibly important issues that are going on in our Western democratic societies. And what I've seen, because I come back, I've been very fortunate, I come back to Australia almost every 6 months, and that's through that 40-year period. So I'm not unfamiliar with what's happening here. But I was hoping that you were more under control than we have been in Canada. And we have a complete steamroller of what are called so-called progressive values. And they are wiping out any more traditional or conservative values. And I'm sure you're going to have, well, you are starting to have exactly the same issues here. So this book is about those values battles, and those battles make up a larger culture war. And I want to try to explain to you what I think is happening in a number of areas. And so one of the questions is, and everybody asks me, well, where does that crazy title come from, Bird on an Ethics Wire? And where it comes from is that I once saw a cartoon, and there were two telephone poles. I think it was in the New Yorker. And there was a whole row of birds along this telephone wire, and all the birds were looking out at you, except one in the middle, and he was turned around the other way, and he was facing in the opposite direction. And the bird next to him said, "Can't we talk about it?" And my thought was, I know exactly how that bird feels. And my answer to can't we talk about it is yes, that we must talk about it. And that's what doing ethics is about. It's about talking about the values that we need, the ones we should preserve, maybe the ones that we should change, and trying to look into that. I'm a pretty controversial figure in Canada, and right near the end, just before we went to press, someone said to me, well, why don't you ask Leonard Cohen's agent? Do you know Leonard Cohen's song, Bird on a Wire? Which I love, actually. And they said, why don't you ask Leonard Cohen's agent if you can use a little quote from his song just at the beginning of that introduction in the book. So I got in contact with Sony, who are his agents, and they had an absolute conniption fit. They told me that if I put anything about Leonard Cohen at all in the book, they'd sue me, and they also said they didn't want me to use the title. But the copyright law says that you can't copyright a title, so they couldn't do anything about that. But it's interesting because my interpretation of it was that they didn't want him associated with me because, you know, I'm a nasty piece of work in a lot of people's eyes. So anyway, I think the bird is also appropriate because birds fly, and flying is a metaphor for freedom, and it's also a metaphor for those who feel imprisoned in some way, the longing to be free, the longing to escape. So that's where the title comes from. And this idea of freedom is very connected into the values issues that we're thinking about. And so one of the issues is, what about restrictions on freedom, and what should they be? And what balance should be struck between total freedom and what we can call freedom in fetters? That is, the restrictions that are needed to make sure that freedom doesn't do more harm than it does good, to make sure that the conditions that are necessary for freedom can be maintained. And one of the fetters that are being identified currently are often, in fact almost always, long-standing, previously fundamental values. For example, the value that you must not intentionally kill another person. Well, that's at the heart of the euthanasia debate, because the people who want euthanasia say this is what we want. And so it's disagreements about where we should draw the lines between the values that we'll continue to accept and implement and those we will reject. That's another way to describe the genesis of the current values conflict. And another thing here is the importance of human memory. And I like that word human memory much better than history. It's John Rolston Saul's term for history. He proposes it in a book called The Unconscious Civilization. And the more the so-called progressive values people, they see history as irrelevant. They see tradition as restricting. And what they've done is that they've started calling people who have conservative values, like I do, they call us restrictives, although the opposite, the antonym of the word restrictive is actually permissive, that you're a permissive. And I don't think they'd like to be called permissives. They want to be called progressives because they're very fussy about words, and permissives might put off a lot of people. And their informing principle, it starts with three C's. It's choice, is a very dominant theme, change, and a belief that change is always for the good, and control, that as much as possible you've got a right to control what happens to you, and particularly your own body. And so they say all of the traditional restrictions, we don't need those anymore. And so they reject history or human memory. But I argue in the book that in order to, we must remember the past to protect the present and the future. And a lot of we call them First Nations people in Canada, but you'd call them Aboriginal people here in Australia. And they have very often, they have a belief which is a process where they talk about looking back 7 generations and looking forward 7 generations in order to decide what to do right now. And I was sitting on an ethics committee for the Nuclear Waste Management Organization in Canada, where we are still trying to work out where to dump this huge amount of nuclear waste. And on that ethics committee, there was one, the chief of the First Nations. He was the top person in the First Nations community. And when it came to his turn to say what did he think we should do and what did he think was ethical, he said, well, you know, if it had been left to us, we would have looked back seven generations to see what the wisdom told us, and we would have looked forward seven generations with our imagination to try to see what impact this would have on those who come after us, and we wouldn't have done it. We wouldn't have the waste in the first place. But then we've got it, so we've got to do something with it. Now, a very dominant theme of the book is that labels and definitions matter, and that stories form us and our society, that labels and definitions are not neutral. And so we can see that, first of all, in the way that the two sides in the values battles are being labelled. First of all, we used to talk about liberal or conservative, and then we went to left-wing or right-wing. Now we've been talking about neoliberal or neoconservative, and most recently we've got progressives, and I'd add to that permissives, versus restrictives. And increasingly a division is being made in the society as a whole between those who are religious and those who are not, and that the stories that they tell are different. And, you know, I mean, my previous book that Gerard mentioned, The Ethical Imagination, was how in a multicultural, multi-religious, secular, democratic Western society we can find some shared values. So if you want to look a lot more into that, you want the Ethical Imagination book. But what happens is this, that we create our multiple complex identities, whether as individuals, families, communities, or a society, through the stories that we tell each other and mutually buy into. We are or become those stories. And so in telling them, our choice of words and the persuasiveness of those stories is a critical issue. And so from that perspective, the present values about battles and the culture wars can be seen as being between competing narratives, each struggling to predominate in establishing the societal values. And there's some very interesting spin-offs from that. For example, in Canada at the moment, the Supreme Court of Canada has demanded that euthanasia be made available, that it's going to be legalised. And there's a huge battle going on between the pro-euthanasia and the anti-euthanasia, which are two manifestations of the progressives and the conservatives. And what is interesting is that the progressives want to try to force doctors, and they're trying to force, for example, Catholic hospitals and Jewish hospitals, which also object to this, to provide euthanasia. And these doctors and these hospitals are saying no. And, you know, your first thought is, well, we're supposed to be a tolerant, democratic society. Why would they want to force these people against their conscience, against the religious beliefs of some of them, to do this? And I had to give a speech on that recently. I'm actually digressing here, but it doesn't matter. Jerry's given me 40 minutes if I want it. He's looking a bit threatening there. But anyway, why would they do that? And suddenly it hit me. I know why they're doing it. They want objection, and they want to show that they can override the objection, because that instantiates their values as the values that are going to dominate. And if they don't have any objection, they can't prove that theirs are the dominant values. And I think that that's what's happening there. Anyway, we've got some really difficult issues. And in contemporary secular societies, the most important of the values we distill from our collective stories are enacted in law, which can be seen as the most important meta-narrative. That is the narrative that joins together all of the others. And that establishing the values in that society. So it's to be expected, as is the case, that there'll be heated battles over the law that should govern, for example, abortion, euthanasia, or same-sex marriage. Sometimes, especially in relation to novel situations that raise ethical issues, such as assisted human reproductive technologies, our collective values are instantiated, at least temporarily, when we're uncertain of what the law should be in ethical precepts. One way to envisage the relation of law and ethics in contemporary Western democratic societies is to see the law as their mind and ethics as their soul. And it merits noting that we may intuit what is ethical or unethical before we can clarify the reasons for our beliefs, which can help to explain why ethical governance of new technologies, for instance, can precede their legal regulation. For people who are religious, faith beliefs can also play a role in what they perceive as ethical or unethical, and consequently would choose as their society's values. As I discuss in various chapters in Bird, legal, ethical, and religious approaches to establishing collective societal values do not necessarily give consistent answers and can result in conflict as to what those values should be. Now, one reason we have differing values is because we've got different perceptions of what we are dealing with. And I emphasise in the book how radically one person's perception of a situation, belief, or argument can differ from another's, and the major impact those different perceptions have with regard to what we see as ethical or unethical. And one of the clearest examples of this is in relation to abortion. People who are anti-abortion, pro-life, what they see as the unborn child, they see it as a baby, an unborn baby with 10 little fingers and 10 little toes. And the pro-choice people, when you talk to them and they're pro-choice of wanting abortion, they'll tell you it is nothing more than a bunch of cells. That's actually a quote. One of them said to me, who was arguing with me, it's just a bunch of cells. They even have occasionally said, it's just a parasite on the mother's body. Well, you can see that language evokes very different emotional responses and evokes very different moral intuitions about what you're dealing with. I also try to show in Bird how our perceptions can play a role in whether or not we can find meaning in life in the events that we encounter, especially when those events involve suffering. And I think one of the biggest problems for people who are conservative, which I am, is to justify the values we want to uphold and deal with suffering. Suffering is very difficult to deal with unless you've got some existential belief. If you think there is nothing else but you, this life is all that there is, you want out of it and you don't want to suffer and you want a lethal injection, it's very hard to explain why you shouldn't be allowed to have that. And I had an interesting encounter with my students because I was teaching a class of 40 graduate students, and 39 of them thought there was nothing wrong with euthanasia. That's lethal injection. Be clear what we mean by euthanasia. A physician gives someone a lethal injection. And I was absolutely both appalled and astonished. And I went back to my office and I thought, what am I going to do about this? And so I wrote them an email. I sent an email to the whole class and said, look, I think I've really made a mess of this class. If 39 of you think there's not even a question about something being wrong with euthanasia, what is going on? And I got some very thoughtful replies. And one of the most important one was this. It's not that we want it, but we think it's a lesser of two evils. For us, the greatest evil is suffering, and anything that can be done to relieve suffering is therefore a lesser evil and is therefore justified. So I think the challenge for people who think euthanasia is not a good idea, and I think it is an extraordinarily bad idea for society as a whole and the future of our societies. I just did a calculation in Canada because I just appeared before a big parliamentary committee, and they are using Belgium and the Netherlands as a model for putting in law in Canada. So I did a calculation. If we had the same rate of euthanasia as the Netherlands and Belgium, how many people would die in Canada a year through euthanasia? And, you know, the people who are for this say, look, it's a last-ditch thing. It'll be used in rare circumstances. There won't be much of it. But do you know what figure came up? I couldn't believe it. I thought, gee, I've lost my ability to do sums, you know. And I went back and checked it, and it is between 12 and 13,000 people a year would be euthanized if they were euthanized at the same rate as in those countries. I mean, that's astonishing. That has become part of the norm. And so I think that's the sort of thing that we have to look to. Now, another thing, and I'm going to skip this because I know Jared's going to be mean and turf me out of here at a certain point, is the need for transdisciplinarity. And one of the troubles that I get into is that, generally speaking, people either think I'm a philosopher, or when they find out I'm not, they're furious at me. They think I've got no business talking about ethics. And what we are doing, and we're going to do some courses at Notre Dame on this, is that I am what's called an applied ethicist. That means a worker in the trenches. The students I train in that go out into the hospitals and help doctors and nurses and pharmacists and everybody else there to find, when they've got ethical dilemmas, how can they approach them, how can they work them out, how can they try as hard as possible not to do something that's wrong and to do something that's right. And to do that, you can't just do philosophy. You have to be able to take into account all the other threads of knowledge that you want to feed into that. And you also have to understand the methodologies that you need. I'm not going to go any more into that. I just want you to be aware of it. You can't just turf it all in there, stir it up, and think you're going to get an answer. It doesn't work that way. Now, the other thing is that words matter in this area. Choice of language is absolutely crucial. And a theme running through all the chapters of Bird, which I try to show in relation to a whole lot of different situations, is the powerful influence of the language that we choose to describe our perceptions, a situation, principle, or belief. Now, there's some really interesting work that's coming out on this, because what we are now finding out is, what is the neurological basis of ethical decision-making? And it isn't just neurological, it's probably a whole lot of other things, but what we know is that words affect our intuitions, and we now know that our intuitions are an important way of knowing in ethics. And words also affect our emotions and our emotional response of whether or not we think something is ethical. And so therefore, when you talk about which words you use, what I describe in Bird is that words are a weapon in our battles about values and in the culture wars. And the sort of thing that you can see here is that when you do a survey of the population and you ask them, do they agree with euthanasia, and you define it as a doctor giving a lethal injection to a patient, about 70% say, no, maybe not. And then you say, well, what about a physician-assisted suicide? And they're a little bit more agreeable with that, a slightly larger percentage. And then you come right down the scale and you say things like medically assisted death or physician assisted death, and the figures go down to about 80% approve of that. And yet they don't agree. When you ask them whether they agree with a lethal injection, they don't agree. And the other thing is that we know that they make different decisions for themselves than what they would agree to as the law. So in one study, they had about 60 people who were terminally ill, and they asked them, did they agree with euthanasia? And something like 59 of them said, yes, they did. And then they went back to those 59 people and asked them, would they have euthanasia? And only one out of 59 said, oh, no, I wouldn't have it. But if somebody else wants it, they can have it. So we're dealing with very complex situations here. And one of the things that I think is really worrying, and one of the things that's happened in Canada, is that these public polls have been used in the courts to show that the vast majority, and used by politicians, to show that the vast majority of people want euthanasia. And so we have to be very careful about that, and I think it has to be questioned what that really means when they say that. And what that means, too, is that our answers can be intentionally manipulated by the choice of words that are used, because that changes what we will say, whether it's right or wrong. And another tactic that's being used here, which I think is worth mentioning, is that any opposition to a politically correct or progressive value stance, and the primary example of this is same-sex marriage, is that it's immediately directly labelled as wrongful discrimination and, in the case of same-sex marriage, homophobia. Now, I'm against same-sex marriage, but I am totally against discrimination against gay people. And the reason, because the reason I'm against same-sex marriage is not because it involves gay people, it's because I believe that there is a fundamental human right for a child to have both a mother and a father, and if at all possible, their own biological parents. And what same-sex marriage does, and we're facing this in Canada, is it wipes out that right of the child. Because what marriage does, marriage, I think, is more important for children than it is for adults. I mean, anybody can go off with any adult they want to, but when they get married, they're going to, and even now, people tend, even though they'll live together, if they're going to have kids, an awful lot of them say, well, we're going to get married because we're going to have kids. And so marriage is to do with children. Now, the pro-same-sex marriage argument is that marriage has got nothing to do with children. It's got to do with family. And what you have as a family is a totally open question that you can decide for yourself. It's this gender neutrality. There's no difference between men and women. Well, that's just scientifically not correct in terms of parenting. Men parent differently from women, and children need both. Anyway, because what happened in the situation in Canada was that because there was, this fear of being discriminatory, the court upheld it, that, you know, it was wrong. Again, wrong not to allow same-sex marriage. And we didn't have the empirical evidence. And the argument was kids are just as well. And what the mantra is, any two or more loving people can have, you know, that's a family, that's okay for the child. One of the really in fact, I'm going to Brisbane on Wednesday and to speak at the World Science Festival. And what we will be discussing there are all these new reproductive technologies, because it's way out science that they want us to discuss and the ethics of that. And one of the possibilities now, right on the horizon, two of them actually, one is that we will be able to make a baby between two same-sex parents so that they can have their own shared genetic baby. England has just given permission for a baby to be made with three genetic parents. And the other thing is that they're talking about men being able to bear a baby, go through a pregnancy, because they've just completed the first successful uterine transplants in Sweden, and they've decided that there is no difference in transplanting the uterus to a woman, or to a man, as compared with a woman. So now you see what that would do, because the gay community, the male gay community, is very upset about any inhibition on surrogate motherhood, and so if they could have a uterine transplant, they wouldn't need a surrogate mother. And so people can hardly believe this, you know, with some of the things that are going on, but that's what it is all about. Now, on the other hand, we've always got to learn, and I think there's a lot useful that we can learn from the progressives. But what I argue in the book is that we must take into account their claims. We are no more, if I'm assuming, I don't know what side of this you're on, but if you're a conservative like I am, I'm no more justified in rejecting their claims than they're justified in rejecting mine. So we have to take them both into account. But if the claims of the progressives are not balanced by those with people with countervailing values, I think that the result will be an ethical disaster for our societies. And the progressives are values deconstructionists. They want to deconstruct traditional values, but often they haven't got viable replacements to offer for those values. And their stance, I think, is accurately described, as it was recently by Pope Francis, as adolescent progressivism. You know, the young person who's on fire and thinks they're going to change the world and everything's going to be wonderful. I think it is also utopian totalitarianism. And what I mean by that is that they see themselves as creating a better world and is entitled to impose their values, even at great cost to those who disagree with them, like my conscientious objectors to euthanasia in Canada. And they'll do that to achieve that goal. And it's utopian because they believe that this is all for the good of everyone. And there's an old saying in human rights, which I think is very apropos here. It's that nowhere are human rights more threatened than when we act purporting to do only good. And the reason for that is that the good blinds us to the harms that we're also doing. And I'm very concerned about that. So I think we've got to have a balance between liberty and restriction that we need to keep what we've got. Now, the next thing I talk about in the book is the basis for ethical decision making, and I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail, but there is a book by Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, and it's called, oh, it's there, it's called The Righteous Mind: Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. It is totally fascinating. He's at a big university in New York. He's a research psychologist. And what they did was looked at values that people held about, did you think you should care for people or harm them? Should they be free or could you oppress them? What about fairness as compared with cheating? What about respect for authority compared with scorn for authority? What about loyalty as compared with betrayal? And what they found was that there was a difference between the progressive values people and the conservatives. The conservatives had a lot, they had a much stronger attachment to loyalty and rejected betrayal, and a much stronger attachment to respect for authority and rejected subversion. But for me, the most interesting point was this, that the conservatives had a sense of the sacred, and it wasn't necessarily a religious sacred. It's what I called in my book the ethical imagination, which got me into no end of trouble again. I called it the secular sacred. And what I mean by the secular, what I argued in that book is that everybody and every society needs a sense of the sacred. And what the sacred means is that which we must hold in trust for future generations, that which we must not lay waste to. And for religious people, they have a religious sacred, and that helps them to do that. But I said I also thought we needed this secular sacred, which would be what would people who are not religious hold in trust and not lay waste for future generations. And I called that the secular sacred. And I think the strongest current living example of that is environmentalism. Suddenly all the young people have woken up and said, hey, we can't destroy our physical ecosystem. That's not fair to people in the future, and it's not good for us. Now, what happened with that was that the religious people became furious with me, and they said I was denigrating the sacred by saying you could have a secular sacred. And the secular people became furious with me because they said I was trying to impose religion on them. And one of my students, I was telling my students this, and one of them looked at me and he said, had a very drawly voice, he said, "You know, Professor Somerville, when you've got everyone mad at you, maybe you're on to something important." So I think that's true. And so I think that one of the things that we're dealing with here is that the progressives so strongly favour individual autonomy that it's overriding everything else. Now, birth...
Five minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, what we're going to do here is, this is what Bird's about, evicting religion from the public square, and the short answer to that is no. The important... Everybody's got the right to have their voice heard in the public square. Values conversations and the university as a test case. Worldwide, universities are really, really coming under threat that academic freedom is being shut down in a very major way among the students, among the faculty, among even the topics that can be discussed. So that is about that, and it's about freedom of speech generally. Chapter 3 is the concept of human dignity, and it looks at how the progressives define it as extrinsic. You've got dignity if I see you as dignified. The conservatives describe it as intrinsic. You have dignity because you're a human being, and because you'll always be a human being, you can't lose it. And dignity is very important because it's at the base of a lot of the arguments about what ethics requires. Chapter 4 is about legalising euthanasia. What happened here in Canada was that the Supreme Court identified refusing euthanasia as an act of cruelty and therefore said that kindness required that we implement it. So that's a really important point. Then Chapter 5 is Every Life Beautiful, and that again is about perceptions, it's about abortion, how do we see the fetus. And then Chapter 6 was a case study of a young woman who had a crisis pregnancy, had an abortion and was completely destroyed, you know, absolutely suffered dreadfully as a result of this. And Chapter 7 is about what influence this whole new development of applied ethics is having on our law, and how are the courts and politicians using ethics now to decide what they'll do in law. And Chapter 8 is what questions are we asking in contemporary cultural values conversations, and that actually is questions that I was asked to write op-eds on. I do similar stuff to Jared, you see. I wrote for the newspapers, and the questions were, what lessons could we learn from two films, Amour and Never Let Me Go? How do I think the human race will end? And what will future generations see as the defining event of the first decades of the 21st century? Now, I'm going to skip all of that. Okay, well, I'm going to just say one thing to you. Righto, Jared, I knew he'd be on my case. Now, I suggest at the end of Bird that we're not going to be able to beat people into accepting these conservative values, so somehow we've got to persuade them that they want to do so. And what I suggest the mechanism of that persuasion will be is if we can elicit in them what I call amazement, wonder, and awe. And I think that the new science is very important in this regard. Instead of looking at science as the scientism people do, as the science is going to explain everything, we're just a gene machine, you know, whatever it is, we can say what we now know is so much more than we've ever known. The powers that we've got are so amazing, and that they show this extraordinary reality that we now know that we know hardly anything. And if we react appropriately with humility instead of pride to knowing that we know hardly anything, I think what it does is elicit an experience of amazement, wonder, and awe that can keep us on track for the values that we need to respect the things that are most important to human beings and most important in human life. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Many thanks to Dr. Somerville. Her most recent book, Bird on an Ethics Wire, battles about values and the culture wars. Janet Grundy's got some copies outside for a very competitive price of $40. And for those who can't get a copy, we'll take orders and we'll post them out to you. So we have some copies of the book here, which is recently published in Canada, of course, but we're getting others and we can take orders. So now we come to the question and discussions. We've got about 20 minutes, so I'm going to ask you to keep your comments brief and the responses brief, and we'll be on our way. If you come back here, Dr. Somerville, can I just start off? Look, broadly, I'm in agreement with you, but if you're in a situation where you have to concede that the forces against you have, against your opinions, have been able to establish that their position is a progressive position, and your position is a regressive position, it's pretty hard to win the argument from there, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very hard. You get labelled as... I was described in an editorial in Nature, you know, which is a prestigious science magazine, as Canada's neo-Luddite ethicist. So it's very hard. It's very hard. But you know what? I've got a lot of confidence. And, you know, maybe it's a bit like being an alcoholic, that you have to hit the bottom before you finally say, well, you know, the only way I can go is up. And I'm very concerned about this, but I think we are going to hit the bottom. I don't think that this is a good thing. Just a short while ago, somebody told me that in Belgium, when you're euthanized, you can give permission before they kill you for them to take your organs for transplant. And I didn't believe it. I thought it was somebody fear-mongering about euthanasia. And much as I don't want euthanasia, I don't think fear-mongering is a good thing. But in actual fact, it's true. So, and I mean, one of my predictions would be that once you say, well, it's okay to take the organs after you've euthanized them, you get better organs if you don't kill them first, but you take the organs as the means of euthanasia. Now, you imagine what... Just put that in your imagination for your moral intuition and your examined emotion response. And so that's the sort of thing that I think it might wake up people, and abuses, I think, will wake up people.
An observation, I guess, for a response. What surprises me is how low quality our intellectual debates have become, that on these significant issues, whether it's euthanasia or same-sex marriage, that there's this rapidity to move to apply a label to someone to shut down the debate. And I really don't understand how this has happened so quickly in our society, that it's not... that we've lost this ability to debate on the merits, and we go to this very low-grade use of either emotion or invective. And I don't know where it's failed in the universities, or it surprises me, and I don't understand it, so I'm interested in
the observation. There's a question about the low intellectual quality in the current public debate.
Yes, well, I mean, one of the things is, I mean, this rapidity is not... It's astonishing, because, for example, if you take, again, euthanasia is a very good example. For 2,500 years, physicians have been prohibited from carrying out euthanasia. It gets legalised by a Supreme Court judgment in Canada, but the court says you've got to wait for legislation. So what did the pro-euthanasia people do? They said, well, we can't wait for that. We want it now. So they've implemented a special mechanism in Canada where you can go to a court and the court can give you permission to have euthanasia even though the law is not yet passed. And so after 2,500 years, you can't wait for 3 months to have this. So there's a huge push on this. My colleague, Dr. Harvey Chalchinov, who's a psychiatrist who specialises in psychiatry of dying people, he headed up a commission to inform the government about this, and he has got reservations about euthanasia. I don't think he's totally opposed to it, but it should be super, super rare. And he described trying to argue against euthanasia as being like standing in front of a juggernaut of a huge freight train coming down a very steep hill. It's just enormous. It's just like, and the same thing happened with same-sex marriage. You know, well, I had to have bodyguards and a kidnap-proof car because I opposed same-sex marriage. And so, you know, actually it was quite an adventure. It was like feeling a bit like you were James Bond. But, you know, it was astonishing. And even now, when, you know, I'm usually described as that horrible woman in the newspapers, not by the journalists, but by the people who write the comments on my articles. And they keep telling the Globe and Mail, which is our national newspaper, why do you keep publishing that horrible, awful woman, you know? And so...
Okay, there's a question here. Yeah,
Margo, thank you for your courage and for entering this debate.
Hang on, we're here. You're next.
Okay. Start again. So, yes, Margo, I just want to thank you for your courage and for entering the debate at a very timely point in Australia. I'm interested in the medical profession in particular and this debate, and wondering if you'd like to comment about how they're being active in the debate in Canada. And in particular, I was thinking about your words, the language being important about progressivism, permissive, you know, restrictive, conservative. I find the progressive actually oppressive in relation to the medical profession, where they're actually, you know, being instructed about what to put on death certificates and actually now also requirements on them to either conduct or refer. So where is the permissive progressive in that?
Yeah, you're very right. The so-called progressives, one of their so-called espoused primary values is tolerance. And they're tolerant until you do something that they don't like, when they're not tolerant at all. And so that's exactly what's happening in euthanasia. The doctors who don't want to do this and don't want to have anything to do with it are having a very tough time, and they're fighting about this. My own suggestion to the parliamentary committee was that we should keep this completely outside medicine, so that when you go to a hospital, you go to a doctor, you don't think he's got or she's got the legal power to kill you. And I use the word kill. And then if society wants it, they can have it, but they should have a new profession. We could call it thanatologist or euthanologist or whatever. They should be specially trained. And a colleague and I wrote an article where we set out the conditions for the training, and we took the Hangman's Bible from the turn of the century in England. This was the turn from 19th to 20th century. And those hangmen had to pass an exam to show that they could really kill somebody quickly, cheaply and efficiently, and that's what euthanasia does. So we don't agree, he and I didn't agree with euthanasia, but we were trying to set up an alternative system. And of course it won't happen, because one of the ways that euthanasia is made acceptable is to put it in medicine. You put what I call the white cloak on euthanasia, and people see it as just medicine. And also there's been a huge push to say, this is just another medical treatment. It's no different from anything else. It is. Killing is different from curing or caring. And that's what physicians have always done. They tried to cure where possible, always care, never kill. We're wiping out that last bit.
I think you meant to say they always try to preserve life where possible.
Yeah, okay.
There's a question, Michael.
You mentioned the almost capture of words by progressives. And in relation to marriage equality, I presume people take that all people could marry. And I presume in North America they haven't removed the bar against consanguinity, so that there's still people, brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews can't marry. So it isn't marriage equality when you just see those words.
Yeah.
The suggestion about the capture of words and the word marriage equality, and the comment is that this might be a term that's used, but it doesn't apply to brothers marrying brothers or sisters marrying sisters.
No, but it's not a different exclusion than that which applies to heterosexual couples, because you can't marry your brother or sister either. And so it would fit within marriage equality. But what is happening in both the United States and in Canada is that marriage equality is seen as only the first step. And now there's a very big movement for what is called family equality. And so, for example, in Quebec, because I live in Montreal, the government was providing up to 3 cycles of IVF for people who were infertile. And a lot of the people who were using that were gay married couples. And they said, we've got the right, we're married. Because marriage is a compound right. It's the right to marry and to found a family. And so that's why I support civil unions, because civil unions don't carry the right to found a family. And my only objection to same-sex marriage is what it does to children's rights. I don't object to the adults at all. And so I think we should have civil unions, including heterosexual couples can have a civil union if they want to, but marriage should be for a man and a woman.
Some of this might be brought about because of the cost of medical services and the ability to keep people alive for much longer than they would normally be kept alive, in critical health situations. So do you see it going beyond the ethics question to one of practical economics, where more and more there'll be a competition for who gets the healthcare benefits and who doesn't? And the idea of an 104-year-old having a hip replacement or, whatever, this is the story. I mean, that kind of argument, can you see that creeping in to sort of take over the ethics?
2 responses, Anne, very briefly. In ethics, we're now having serious conversations about expanding the average human life to 150 years. And because they found the genes for aging, and that then brings us into designing your own children and human embryos, and that again is what we're going to discuss in Queensland at the end of this week. And I was teaching a final year medical school class, and I was giving them an anti-euthanasia lecture with a bit of the stuff I've talked to you about tonight. And one of the young men who was just moving out to do his internship in medicine got absolutely furious with me and jumped up and said, look, you can't say no to euthanasia because we have to have it because we've got all these old people. And if we can't deal with them, it's going to wreck our healthcare system and we can't afford it. So even five years ago, if I brought up the issue as an argument against euthanasia, this will be used to save money, people went ballistic. They said, she's scaremongering, it's straw men, of course it won't be used. Now it is an upfront and direct argument that part of the reason we need this is because of the cost. But it will always be marketed under compassion and kindness. And that was what happened in this case in Canada. It is cruel to deny people the right to be dead when they want to be dead.
Question there. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Don't stand in
front. In terms of the soft spots that progressives choose to make these changes, it seems to me that the courts and the legal system are the bunnies. And they're making rulings on the matters that are well beyond their brief and beyond the common law, statute law, you name.
Okay, the suggestion is that
can you comment on that?
The area that you're talking about, what we've got here is court-driven or judge-driven law.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And if you want an extraordinary example, again in this brief I did before Parliament, we looked at how many times had euthanasia been presented, or euthanasia and assisted suicide legislation been talked about or presented in the Parliament since 1991. And it was 15 times. And the last time was in April 2011, and legalising euthanasia was voted down by the whole Canadian Parliament, 228 against 59-4. And now we've had 9 judges, unelected judges, on the Supreme Court of Canada say, you can't do that. It is unconstitutional to prohibit euthanasia. Now, one safeguard that you've got in Australia, although it's not as solid as it used to be, is that you don't have a Charter of Rights. that puts the individual person's rights up against the right of the state to pass legislation. But, you know, the High Court of Australia has been finding that there are these sort of penumbra of these rights, and who knows what they might decide, you know, if they get a euthanasia case before them of some individual who says, I've got the right to this. You might know that the UK has just voted down legalising euthanasia, and the House of Lords decided they would not endorse it. It was a strange judgment. It's a judgment called, Nicholson. And they didn't say that they didn't have the power. They just said they weren't going to do it. And that's called deference to the legislature. And that's usually what happens. And maybe you'll get that here. But I'm not so sure about the Australian legislatures, because I understand that last week there's been a bill introduced into the Commonwealth Parliament to override Kevin Andrews' bill that overrode the Northern Territory euthanasia bill. So
question here.
Margot, I wondered if you might say something about the way in which you speak to your philosophical colleagues in the context of the university. You're critical of the way in which ethics is taught. I wondered how you manage that in the university context.
You know, they tolerate me, Sandy. They kind of... I had an experience quite a long, long time ago. I was asked to give a paper at a criminal mental health conference about, you know, people who've got mental illness, and I gave this pretty challenging paper, and there were people from all over the United States there, and this reminds me of the philosophers, and this guy is a big, tall, about 6'4" tall lawyer from Texas, and I was sitting at the dinner table, and he walked up behind me and he patted me on the head like this, and he said, I just can't believe it. A little girl like you telling all these grown men what to do. And I often feel like that with the philosophers. They sort of look at me and sort of say, but you're not a philosopher, you know, you can't talk about ethics. But I try to explain to them that we've all got to talk about ethics. And I see myself as a translator between what we do in the theoretical and research sphere in ethics, in relation to science in general, but medicine in particular, and translating that in such a way that that people can understand it. Just a second. See, this would have been my last slide. I believe that we've got duties to the public of what I call effective informing, because in a democratic society, if democracy is going to last, those people are the ones who need to know what it is they're voting for, who it is they're voting for, and what they think. And that was the final thing. I think that's also important in terms of the ambience that we create. That's an old Chinese proverb that, you know, the bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song. And I think that's what I said about that is those ancient poet prophets who penned the Psalms knew our values message is much more likely to be welcomed as a song than an answer. And so I think what we're up against now is to work out things that will become values hit songs. And I don't know how we're going to do it, but we can try. And the problem with the philosophers has been is that they really are, not all of them, but a lot of them are in a high ivory tower, and they don't understand that their song has to be made into pop music. It can't remain classical, which is what it's been.
It's a very good spot to end, because we're right on time, so many thanks for that. We are right on time. And you got your conclusion in, you see. It always comes from I knew you would. So look, many thanks to Margaret Somerville. The book Bird on an Ethics Wire, as I said, Janet Grundy's got some copies of it. It's great that you're coming back to Australia. I'm sure you're going to get involved in the public debate here, which is an important debate. I'm hoping you won't need armoured car protection, but I'm not sure, actually, but I'm hoping you won't. But your contribution will be a very important one. This is obviously a very significant book. the issues you're talking about have become very prominent, as you know, in the last decade, really only in the last decade, but most of the issues have become prominent in the last decade, and you're going to be here making a contribution. So I must say I admire your intellectual courage. It's not all that common around Western democracies these days that people on the conservative side of the argument will stand up. Most don't. And I'm delighted that you're here tonight standing up. So well done, and good luck with the book. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.